MechCast, Saturday, April 7th, 2012. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. You know, it has been a crazy week for me. It's been a crazy week for Apple, and actually not in a really good way. For me, I had my taxes due this week, so I'm a little bit behind and owing a lot of money, I think is how that story ends. And for the Mac, it looks like we're having our first kind of real security issue and breach. And we're going to be talking about that in this episode. But before I dive into all of that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that's Gazelle. You know, if you want to get cash for your old Apple products, your iPhone, your laptop, your iPod, your iPad, maybe something that you want to sell to fund a new purchase of some Apple gear, Gazelle is a great place to do that because they make it really quick and easy, and you don't have to deal with all the hassles of auction sites and classified listings and all that junk. Because what Gazelle does is they are a re-commerce service. So you go to their website, you tell them what you have, you do a simple search, it's right there. They list all the different Apple categories of products, and then you answer some simple questions about the condition of your item and the types of accessories and things that you have, and then they analyze what you got and give you a straightforward upfront offer. They say, hey, we'll give you this much for it, and if you choose to accept that offer, they will pay for the shipping. In some cases, they will even provide a shipping box. You box it all up, you send it in, they receive it, they take a look at it, make sure everything matches what you told them it does, and then you get paid. It's really that simple, and you can get paid by check, you can get paid by PayPal, you can get an Amazon gift card, or you can even have the value of your item donated to charity. They have a bunch of approved charities, and you can just select one of those and give back. So lots of different options, quick and easy. Great way to get cash for your old Apple gear. Check it out over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. And, you know, I probably should look around here and see if I can find some stuff to send their way. Maybe I can cover some of that tax bill I got this week. I love this time of year. Don't you? You know, it's our civic duty, but I wish it wasn't such a large civic duty sometimes. Okay, enough of that. You don't want to hear about my moaning on tax season. Let's get into some of the news and what's been going on. Specifically, and unfortunately, we're going to kick it off with a little bit of bad news. Or not, you know, this is not really that bad of news. It's something that you do need to be aware of, though, as a Mac user. There is a new exploit targeting the Mac, and this one is particularly nasty. It's actually a variant of something we've seen on the Mac before, the Flashback Trojan. This one's labeled Flashback.k, or Flashback K, and it exploits a new flaw, or a flaw in the Java code. Not necessarily new, as you're going to find out here. Actually knew about it since February. But exploits a flaw in the Java code and could allow an attacker to exploit the Mac by installing software. The problem this time around, though, is that it can do it without requiring admin access, and it can do it in the background without you knowing. Now, the vulnerability that allows this to happen was actually patched by Oracle, as I just said, back in February, and Apple just this week released two updates for Lion and Snow Leopard. I think you only need the second one now, but they released one and then quickly released another one, patches for Java. And there are no patches if your system is earlier than OS 10.6 or 10.7. So I don't know what you're going to do if you're running one of those older versions of the operating system. Hopefully, Oracle or somebody will put out some binary builds for those models, but you're not going to get those directly through Apple. And just so you know, Lion does not come pre-installed with Java. So if you're running Lion and you're not running Java, you're probably pretty well protected from this one because it does rely on that. Now, a Russian antivirus company, Dr. Webb, claims that the flashback Trojan now controls over 500,000 Macs on the web. And there were some other numbers this week that said it might even be higher than that, 650,000, 700,000 Macs in this sort of bot network caused by this flashback Trojan. And I think that's all the different variants, you know, the ones that had been around. The previous one, why it's called flashback, was installed. You'd go to a malicious website and it would say, hey, you need to install Flash. And then when you would download the Flash, the fake Flash installer, and run it, you would get this on your system and then be added to this giant bot network that's been growing. But in this latest variant, if you want to check and see if you got hit by it, you can do that from the terminal, and I'll have all the instructions for this in the show notes at maccast.com. You can also find them online, but basically you go into Applications Utilities, you launch the terminal application, and then there's two little command lines that you run, and what you want to check for is that the result in both cases says does not exist. It'll, you know, talk about a certain file that would be in place, put in place by the Trojan. And as long as those files don't exist, then your system would be clean. If you do have those files, then you can find instructions on how to remove those. Again, I'll try and put those links in the show notes at maccast.com. I don't want to go into the technical details of it, but a good way, if you don't have it or if you just want to keep yourself protected, is to disable Java on your Mac if you don't need it. As I said, if it's not installed, you don't have to worry about it. If you have installed it but you're not using it, or if you're running Snow Leopard, you can go into the Applications Utilities folder, and there should be a Java Preferences app. Launch that and just make sure that you uncheck everything in the General tab to disable Java. And then you also want to make sure that you disable Java in your browser. In Safari, you go into Safari Preferences, you go under the Security tab, and just make sure that you uncheck the Enable Java option. Turn that off, and that way you can make sure that you can't get hit by this virus. And patch your system. If you've patched your system, you should be pretty safe to continue to run Java, at least maybe until the next exploit. And so let's talk about that a little bit. So what should you do moving forward, maybe more proactively, to protect yourself? Well, I know all the standard security measures apply. Don't click on links you don't know the source of. Don't download software from unknown websites. You know, kind of question stuff. But especially with this particular variant showing up, the fact that it doesn't require admin access and kind of run in the background, this is really the first time we've seen something in the wild that Mac users, I think, really might want to pause and think maybe it's time to start installing antivirus software. Of course, you're not going to get protected for a zero-day exploit like this necessarily. You could be that first person that gets hit, but the thing about it is once the first person gets hit and it's made aware that this is out there, vendors tend to update their definitions very, very quickly. So if you're running antivirus, you could get the update of the antivirus in the protection before you actually encounter the virus in the wild. And so it's not a bad idea. And there's a couple great free options out there. I just found out that Sophos has a free version of their antivirus package. They're well known in the community and pretty good. One that's been around for a long, long time, Clamex AV, is really great. That's free. So we've got two great free solutions, and I'll have links for all of these in the show notes at maccast.com. And then there's a couple good commercial ones, Intego Virus Barrier and ESET Cybersecurity for Mac, both very good products, and you could check those out and consider running those, especially if you have a friend or a family member who's not quite as tech savvy. It might be time for them to be running something that's actively scanning their system to make sure that they don't get hit by this stuff. And I've been emailing back and forth with George Starcher, who's come on the program before. He works in the security industry, and you know, he pointed out we should have known something like this was coming, or we all kind of knew the day was going to come when this was going to happen. And he said, really, what he would recommend is, one, make sure that you patch your system, run software update, and get the patches. Don't run your system as admin, and we've talked about that security measure on the Maccast. You know, when OS X installs, it sets up an admin account, but you don't have to run your main user account as your admin account. So set up user accounts and run under those, and that way you won't have exploits won't have heightened permissions to install things. You may consider using an alternative domain name service, a DNS service like OpenDNS. And the reason for that is OpenDNS maintains a list of malicious domains, IPs, and websites, and will actually block those sites automatically for you. I actually use OpenDNS, and that's a really great service, easy to set up. You can configure the DNS in your system preferences, in the network preferences, or you can do it on your router. If you have an airport, it's pretty easy to change which domain name servers you're using. You don't have to use the ones that come from your ISP. And just go to OpenDNS, and you can get the numbers that you need to set that up. And then lastly, he said, you know, maybe you want to run antivirus. If you have sensitive data on your system, it might not be a bad idea at this point. And again, I gave you a couple links to different options for that. So get yourself protected and just be aware. You know, awareness is probably 90% of this stuff, right? And it's just make sure you tell your friends and family and let them know what's going on. And we'll just all keep each other in the loop and we'll all try and stay safe. Now, something else that is completely separate but equally concerning, a security issue that came up this week, has to do more with privacy. And we've been talking a lot about privacy with some of the things like Path and different apps that were uploading address book data and doing that in sort of an unencrypted fashion and maybe with or without really making users aware that they were doing that. Some were, some weren't. But we talked about that a little bit. This week, it came out that Facebook and Dropbox, their iOS applications, are actually storing user credentials on the device in plist files unencrypted. So these are just property list files, and anybody that would have physical access to your iOS device, so when you dock the iOS device in and it gets backed up by iTunes, or just simply when it's docked on a USB cable, there's software that you can run, and it doesn't require jailbreak or anything like that. As a matter of fact, I have one of the applications, Phone View from Ecamm, and it lets you dock your phone, physically connected on a cable, and then browse through the files that are on there. So you can go into the applications, and you can get to these plist files. And that's where the security concern comes into play. But as I mentioned, you do need to have physical access to the device, so this would really only affect you if you lost your phone or someone stole it from you or someone else was in your house unbeknownst to you and was rooting through your phone as it was connected to a system. So it's not necessarily something we need to be super alarmed about. And I think Dropbox already came out and said they're going to issue a patch soon. But the point is they should have never done this in the first place, right? They shouldn't have had made this unencrypted. It's just another example of these sort of companies taking and making brash decisions about security and privacy and stuff like that. And so it's another good reason why we really need to start thinking about proactively taking that defense into our own hands, meaning make sure you're doing things like putting a passcode lock on your phone. That way, if someone gets physical access to it, they can't get in and access the data directly on the device. Also, when you're doing your backups in iTunes, there is a checkbox that says to encrypt your iOS backups. If you encrypt your backups on your Mac, then someone can't just go in and get to those files directly that are sitting on your drive. And that's one of the ways to get at this information. There's a bunch of tools that can go through your backup files and find these plist files as well. So just a couple things to be aware of security-wise here at the top of the show this week. We got good news late this week, actually today, Saturday, that if you buy movies through iTunes, Universal has now been added to the list of studios that will allow iTunes cloud re-downloads to Macs and iOS devices, as well as streaming of their movies to the Apple TV 2. If you remember, Apple enabled re-download service for movies back in March when they made the announcement of the new iPad. Studios like Sony were on the list at the time, but Universal and Fox were excluded. Apparently, I guess this was due to some sort of exclusivity agreements for the TV releases of movies on HBO. HBO had said, I think, after the announcement was made that they would be working with the studios to renegotiate. I guess HBO and Universal have reached an agreement. Unfortunately, Fox is still in talks. So for now, it's Universal being added, and we'll have to wait on Fox movies. But only one more major studio, I believe, still holding out for re-downloads on iTunes Cloud. And for me, that's good news, because I am starting to consider purchasing more movies directly through iTunes because I can re-download them. It makes it much more convenient, and I don't have to worry about storage. My big thing always was that I liked having the physical DVD because there was no other way. I didn't want to have to manage the data, right? Manage those big, large files. And now that I can just be assured they're up on Apple servers and I can pull them down or stream them whenever I want, that makes my buying decision a little bit easier. And I think that's good news for Apple and iTunes. And hopefully they can get Fox on there pretty soon as well. Seems like it's been a really long time since we talked about Mac rumors. We actually got some Mac rumors this week about new systems coming on board. Unfortunately, for a lot of you, it's not Mac Pros. We're not hearing about Mac Pros, although I imagine those are going to be updated sometime soon because there's new processors out there. Then it's just the Mac Pros are ripe for an update. But this week, DigiTimes is quoting a report from China's Economic News Daily. And I'll just say this up front. China's Economic Daily News has put out Mac rumors in the past, and they have not been very accurate. Their track record's not very good. But they're saying that supplier checks seem to be indicating that there are new iMacs and MacBook Pros on the horizon featuring Intel's latest Ivy Bridge technologies, and they could be arriving around the June timeframe, which would make sense. That would put it in line for potentially coming out with the release of Mountain Lion, although Mountain Lion's just been said, hey, it's coming out this summer. That could be anywhere from June until September. So maybe it would or would not coincide with the operating system update. But regardless, new systems, what they're saying about them is speculation is that they would feature the latest Core i7 and i5 quad-core processors from Intel. They'd get bumped up integrated graphics, moving them to the new Intel HD 4000 chipset. That's the default chipset. And then, of course, there'd be dedicated processors as well on the higher-end models or discrete processors. Also, Apple may employ new glass technology from a company called G-Tech that would help reduce some of the glare on those glossy displays. That would be a welcome update for a lot of graphics people I know. And then they're also reporting that the new iMac designs could end up being thinner than the current models. And the reason for that is that they may lose the optical drives. Also being predicted that the MacBook Pros would get a similar kind of digital liposuction, and their optical drives would be expunged as well in order to make that happen. So thinner models, thinner iMacs, thinner MacBook Pros, and maybe some new models showing up here in June. So if you've been considering a new Mac purchase, you might want to hold off for a month or two. There was some great news this week for AT&T customers who have an iPhone and are now off contract. You've met your contract requirements and you want to take that iPhone, maybe give it to someone else, maybe go to a pay-as-you-go plan or put it on to another carrier like T-Mobile just by swapping out the SIM. Well, problem we've always had is that AT&T phones were locked and AT&T would not unlock them. Earlier this week, we heard reports that Tim Cook's office was actually stepping in on behalf of some customers who were complaining and forcing AT&T, or at least prodding AT&T, to unlock those customers' devices. And apparently when this would happen, people would send an email to Tim Cook's office, then Tim Cook's office would contact AT&T customer service, and then they would contact the customers back and actually unlock their devices. Well, starting tomorrow, Sunday the 8th in the U.S., you're not going to have to worry about that anymore, because the Mac Observer is reporting that AT&T will start unlocking iPhones for qualified devices. What it takes to be qualified, the requirements are that your account must be in good standing with AT&T. You cannot have a device associated with a current active contract, a term commitment with AT&T. You need to have fulfilled that existing contract term, so you need to be out of your contract, or you need to have upgraded under one of their upgrade policies, or paid your early termination fee. If you meet all those requirements, then they will unlock your device. Unlocking will allow you to then take that and get an AT&T pay-as-you-go plan, put it on another network domestically, or take it abroad. So if you want to go international and get a compatible SIM in another country, you'll be able to do that now with your device, assuming it supports, of course, the bands. And that's one of the things about T-Mobile in the States. You can go over to T-Mobile. Their voice network supports the iPhone, but their 3G data network is not compatible in all places. I think actually relatively very few places, but you can get 2G data. So it's an option, and it's just nice to finally be able to have that done. They didn't give a lot of details on exactly what you'd need to do. I would assume you just have to call AT&T customer service, because I believe the process is they just send a little code to your phone, and then the next time you dock it into iTunes, it simply calls out to Apple servers and then unlocks the device. I think it really is that simple. So why they weren't doing that before, who knows, but they're going to be doing it starting this Sunday. So good news. One of the key technologies that's in the iPhone 4S Apple has used to really market the device is Siri. And it turns out that Siri, at least according to one report, is a pretty busy lady. The Wall Street Journal has an article reporting on an unpublished report from a consulting firm, Park Associates. Supposedly, they went out and surveyed 482 owners of the iPhone 4S and found that about 87% of them were using at least one feature of Siri each month. And it seems like most people are using it for kind of routine tasks, doing things like placing phone calls or listening to music. 33% said they were placing phone calls, sending texts, or looking up information daily with Siri. 32% said they were using it to control music. 35% said they were using the scheduling and calendar feature. 26% claimed that they were dictating email almost daily. That one surprised me a little bit. That's a pretty high number. I haven't really use that feature too much, although I have to be honest, I'm starting to use it a lot more. I'm realizing that the dictation feature, especially on my new iPad, is very accurate and it processes very quickly. I don't know how that works since it's going over the network, but it certainly is amazing to me. And about 55% of the people in the survey said they were very satisfied with the features of Siri. So very popular. The survey itself, 482 owners, that's not a huge sample set. But just in talking to people about Siri and how they use it, I found that those people that do have it seem to use it and like it very much. And I have to count myself in that group. So if you are using Siri, I'd love to know what some of your favorite features are and how frequently you're using it. It does surprise me that many of these people said they were using it on a daily basis. I don't know if I'm using it daily, but I'm certainly using Siri a few times a week. All right, are you ready for a shocking statistic? Did you know that iPhones are popular with teens? At least according to one report, I think actually probably more than one report, but there was a report this week that 1/3 of high school students in the U.S. actually already own an iPhone. This is according to Piper Jaffray analyst Gene Munster. They surveyed 5,600 U.S. high school students, and they found that 34% of the students surveyed already own an iPhone, and that's up from about 23% when they did a similar survey in the fall and 17% from last spring. So that's what, like double from a year ago. So that is a very rapid rate of adoption, at least in that one segment. And they also took a look at tablets and found that 34% of students reported also owning a tablet device of some sort, with 70% of them indicating that that tablet was an iPad. 53% of the iPad owners also said that they owned an iPhone. So about half of them owning multiple devices, iPad, iPhone. And that was, again, up from 29% in the fall of 2011 and 22% last spring. And so I guess with the reports of the Trojan out there and potential exploits along with some of the other app security data issues that we talked about earlier in this episode. Everybody is really kind of looking at Apple and what they're doing surrounding security. And Ars Technica decided to kind of dive into iCloud and take a look at the terms of service and got some privacy experts to help them take a look at, you know, what is Apple doing to protect your data and how secure is it and stuff like that when you're putting it up into iCloud. And the general consensus among the experts was that the data security Apple was using meets industry best practices. But I think a lot of hardcore privacy experts and security experts kind of agree that industry best practices at this moment in time aren't necessarily always consumer best practices or don't always put protection of your personal data at the top of the list, at least when it comes to search warrants and those sorts of things. Basically, what's going on is in looking at the terms of service, there's room for Apple to be able to review and access your data, and even in some cases, maybe provide that data to authorities under certain circumstances. Now, there's no indication that Apple is or will access your data when you put it up into iCloud, but the terms of service does seem to imply that they have the ability to do so, which would mean that even if the data is stored encrypted, which most believe it is, Apple has the ability to somehow decrypt that. In the terms of service, Apple says that they can pre-screen, move, reuse, modify, or even remove content at any time if the content is deemed objectionable or otherwise in violation of their terms of service. Apple can also access, use, preserve, and or disclose your account information and content to law enforcement authorities whenever required or permitted by law. So I would assume in the cases where they would get a search warrant for your data, they could potentially provide that over to authorities. Again, we don't know yet if they actually would, given that situation, but they definitely have the capability, which was where the concerns were kind of raised by privacy experts. Now, where my concerns were raised a little bit was the terms of service went on further to say that Apple will review content reportedly in violation of copyright under the DMCA statutes. And the article didn't make it clear exactly what action, if any, Apple might take if it discovered a violation of the DMCA. But the ability to kind of review the content that you might be storing in iCloud and then deem that maybe that's stolen or pirated content, and potentially do anything up to and including maybe reporting you to authorities, that concerns me a little bit because Apple needs to stay in the good graces of the MPAA and the RIAA, and that relationship could potentially at some point turn Apple into sort of a content police, and I don't think any of us want that. Now, I don't think that's happening right now. I don't think Apple would actually probably take on that role, at least not willingly, but just the fact that they have the potentially have the capability to do that is something that I think we all need to know about and be a little bit concerned about. The article goes on to point out that they could do a little bit better job of protecting this stuff by using an asymmetric public key encryption rather than the symmetric encryption, basically meaning that do a one-way encryption scheme where we would hold the keys and the data would be encrypted before it was uploaded to iCloud rather than it being sent over an encrypted SSL connection and then encrypted, the actual data being encrypted when it's stored on Apple servers with their keys, giving them the ability to decrypt it. Now, of course, going back to what we were talking about earlier, I think the reason I'm bringing this up is because we need to be aware of how this stuff works. And we need to start taking that responsibility upon ourselves. So if this really does concern you, then you should be taking steps and measures to protect and encrypt your own data. There's nothing to stop you from using a public key encryption scheme. Encrypt the data on your Mac before you let it get backed up or uploaded to iCloud, and then you would be protected. You could do this yourself, but I do think that services like Dropbox, services like iCloud and Apple should be thinking about using more of that asymmetric style system because it's just a better method of doing it, and it also takes some of the responsibility away from them for the data. You know, they're not going to really know what you're putting up on their servers, and then they can just say to law enforcement, "Hey, we don't know what that stuff is. You need to go after the individuals directly to get at that data." Really, Apple is just providing a service here, and it's not something that they should have to be concerned about. They should not have to be the police or even involved in that sort of thing, at least in my opinion. And so I think industry best practices need to be made a little more consumer-oriented and a little less corporate-oriented. And then the last thing I have for you this week is actually a bunch of little things. There were a bunch of little rumors surrounding iOS and the next generation iDevices. And to kick things off, let's talk about what John Gruber said. He said that Apple has a prototype, at least a prototype, 7.85-inch iPad in the works with a resolution of 1024 by 768 to keep things nice and easy and clean for developers in terms of getting apps running on a smaller form factor tablet from Apple. You know, on this one, I fully believe that there is a prototype device floating around in that form factor at that size. I think that Apple is constantly staying on top of when they might have different devices to compete in different markets. Now, obviously, something like that is going to be targeting the people who want a smaller form factor, something like the Amazon Fire, and there's rumors that Google's going to do a tablet in that form factor as well. So Apple is going to want to be prepared when that hits. But for now, with how well the current iPad is selling and not seeing it wane anytime soon, I don't think that's anything more than a prototype at this point, something that Apple's playing with, that they're getting ready. But I wouldn't expect that we would see it this year. And I don't know that Gruber had said that it was necessarily coming out. He was just saying that he had heard that it existed. Samsung Display says that Apple will be switching their smartphone displays to their technology. They formed a new division recently, and I believe the CEO or president, somebody like that, came out and said that Apple will be using their OLED smartphone displays in potentially the next generation of the iPhone, which presumably would be the iPhone 5 coming out in the fall, sometime around the October timeframe. So, you know, I don't know if I put a lot of stock in this one. Apple has kind of avoided so far to date OLED displays, but Apple's going to always go with the best display technology they can get their hands on at the best price. So performance-wise, if these displays are better than what Apple's using now, certainly could happen. Another thing that we heard about this week was that Apple is going to be dropping Google Maps in the next version of iOS, iOS 6, in favor of the OpenStreetMap data. We did see in the iPhoto application that Apple just launched recently for iOS that they are not using Google Maps. It does appear that they're using OpenStreetMap data. And we all know that Apple and Google's relationship has been rocky, with Steve saying that he was going to declare the equivalent of global thermal nuclear war on Google over the Android operating system. So I'm sure Apple would love to not have to be paying Google all the licensing fees that they have to for the mapping software. And we know that Apple acquired like three different mapping companies over the last couple years. Two, Poly9 and C3, are focused on 3D mapping technologies, really cool 3D mapping stuff, if you've ever seen the videos and information that's out there online. And another company called PlaySpace that offers services very similar to what Google Maps offers, including the ability to overlay all kinds of other data on top of the mapping data. So if Apple's going to get maps from the OpenStreetMaps project and then sort of layer on some of these other technologies, use some of the resources that they acquired, specifically the engineering talent that they acquired from these other companies, there's no doubt that they could create a very compelling and probably even better mapping system than what Google has potentially. So I'd love to see what Apple can do when they start messing around with maps. I think we'd get some amazing technologies, and whether it'll show up in the next generation of iOS, I do think it's plausible, because we are seeing inklings of it in iPhoto. So that might be Apple playing around with it, seeing how it works, and getting it ready for a release in the fall. I'd certainly be welcome and open to seeing that. And then finally, analyst Peter Misick claims that the Apple-branded TV is actually going to be coming soon. Actually, very soon, according to his report. And it'll actually be called the iPanel. He says that Apple's going to begin production on about 5 million iPanels starting in May. So I'd assume if they're producing them in May, we'd see a release sometime this summer. And he said the panels will retail for $1,250 US and are expected to bring in gross margins of about 30%. I didn't get any details on the size of the iPanels. I don't know if it's a 32-inch, a 42-inch TV. I have no idea. I didn't see that in the report. Maybe I just missed it. If you happen to know, send me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. But then he also claims that Apple will be using new Sharp IGZO panels, I-G-Z-O, and I never know how to say that. I think it's IGZO panels, which is supposedly this amazing low-power technology. And Sharp has been showing this off at CES and other places, and it's supposed to be very nice-looking displays and get very great power consumption. A lot of people were thinking that it might be technology that would show up in a new iPad. We obviously didn't get that in the new iPad, but maybe Apple's going to put it out in some sort of new display. And why it's being called the iPanel, I think he said that a big part of the reason is that the ITV trademark in the UK is held by another company, and Apple just might not want to fight that battle. I'm also wondering if iPanel truly is the name, and right now I'll tell you, I don't put very much stock in this rumor. But just let's assume that iPanel is the name. It could be that I always thought that Apple might have their next generation displays be a combo display and television. 32-inch would be ideal for that. You know, bump up from the current 30-inch display that they have now, build in TV functionality and Apple TV functionality all into one unit. And I think you could have a compelling display. At $1,250, that sounds about the right price point for high-end Apple display. I think, what do they run right now? About $999 for the 27-inch LCD cinema display. So we'll have to see. And this summer, maybe along with an updated revved Mac Pro, that would be a nice little combination to have come out. So that's going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to take another quick moment and thank one of our show sponsors, Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze. If you haven't checked out Deep Freeze, head over to the website and take a look. If you're in IT, if you are in education and you're managing a bunch of Macs, maybe in a lab, something like that, Deep Freeze is perfect software for you. You can save on your IT costs. What it allows you to do is take your Macs, set them up, and then freeze them, lock their configuration, all the software, all the operating system settings, everything that you've put on there in place. You can then deploy those machines out to your labs, out to your users, and know that the operating system and all the applications and things like that are going to be protected. But what's great about it is it's not the type of technology that gets away in the way of the users. A lot of this stuff, a lot of times, you're working on the system, you need to do anything, and suddenly it's popping up little dialogues and asking for permissions, and you got to contact the IT department. None of that with the Deep Freeze. It allows you access to the system, and also you can define areas for your users called thaw spaces, and these can be folders, these can be the entire home directory where they can actually save and persist documents and data between sessions. But what'll happen is they can go in, they can install software, they can browse the web, they can do anything they want, and they can even write to those protected areas during a session. But after they're done, all an IT person has to do is reboot that system, and Deep Freeze will kick in and restore the operating system, restore all of the protected areas back to their original pristine state, all with just a simple reboot. And the tool has integration with your remote management tools, things like Apple Remote Desktop. And so it's just really well thought out and well executed, and you really should check it out. They have trials available if you'd like to do that. And you can get more information and details over at Phoronix.com. Big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. On a recent episode of the MacCast, I spoke about how to share your iTunes purchases if you had separate Apple IDs. But I didn't exactly cover all the ins and outs of how you would go about doing that. So I thought I'd follow up a little bit. I had a couple people ask me the question. And in essence, so say you have a family, you have two people, maybe yourself and a spouse, and you each have your own Apple IDs, and you've made purchases under your own Apple IDs on your own Macs, but now you want to be able to share applications or music or movies, what have you, you can actually copy that content from one iTunes account to the other. And probably the easiest way to do that is to just go into iTunes. Well, there's two easy ways to do it, but I'm going to tell you the kind of really manual way first. So go into iTunes, just drag whatever bit of content out, be it an album, a piece of music, a movie, what have you, and then either over the network, drop it to the other Mac, or you can sneakernet it over, you know, put it on a flash drive and walk it over, or external hard drive, whatever you'd like to do. And then when you get it to the other system, go ahead and just put it into the iTunes library on that system. And then when you go to access that content, to play it, to sync it to your device, whatever, it's going to ask you to authenticate. And you just need to authenticate under the original Apple ID that that content was purchased under. And once you've done that, it's authorized on that Mac, and you're able to sync it to your devices and play it and work with it. Now, the even easier way to do this stuff, if you'd like, is to use home sharing. And I didn't know about this till just recently. Somebody pointed this out to me. You can actually use home sharing even if you've used separate Apple IDs to make your purchases. You just need to make sure that you use one single Apple ID for all of your home sharing. So you can go on to your spouse's machine and enter in your Apple ID as the home sharing ID, and then anything that's purchased under that one account, you can transfer over to the other system using home sharing. And once the two machines are connected, you can see the content both ways. So you can copy from one to the other either way. And if you're pulling stuff, say, from your spouse's computer that was purchased under their Apple ID, pull that over to your computer, all you're going to have to do is, once you get that content again and try and access it or use it, it's going to ask you to authenticate. You authenticate using your spouse's Apple ID, and that content should work. And you can even go one step further and set up the auto transfer of any purchases using the home sharing feature. All you have to do is go under the settings button and make sure that you check on the purchase types that you want to automatically sync. So be that music, movies, TV shows. So if you are in iTunes, you go under the library, under the shared section, select the home share. And then in the main window down in the bottom right, you'll see a little settings button. Click that and you'll see all the options for setting up automatic syncing of purchased content. And once you've done that, then you can share all that content between two different Macs using two different Apple IDs to actually make the purchases. So that's how you actually do that. One of the big things that I try and do on the MacCast, when I'm looking at stories and I'm going over stuff, I try very hard to be objective and try and get all sides of a particular topic or story and deliver that information to you so that you can make decisions and kind of decide for yourself, as you know, what you think about the stuff that comes out. And something that happened recently with the launch of the new iPad, actually this happens every time a new Apple product comes out, is that there's generally issues that are found, and then those issues get reported in the media. They often get very hyped and I think a little bit blown out of proportion. I'm going to admit right up front that I'm generally biased towards Apple. I think there's no, I mean, I do a show called the MacCast, right? So I don't think anybody's confused about that. But again, I try and back away from that, back away from my own thoughts and opinions as much as possible. And I always tell you when I'm sharing my opinion, I'm going to be sharing my opinion, a little bit of my opinion in this segment here, but try and back away from that and just deliver you the facts and ask you to kind of decide. And so there's been a lot of hype around a couple different issues related to the new iPad. And I'm not saying the issues are real or not real, and I'm not saying that they're not valid, but I think that in many cases, they're being overhyped by the media. And I will say that so far, I've only had a handful of MacCast listeners actually report to me that they're having any of these issues that are in question. And I've been polling a lot of my friends who purchased new iPads to find out if they're being affected by any of these issues that are being reported. And most of them are telling me no. I had one person who had an issue, and it was actually resolved by just getting a replacement iPad from Apple. So the current kind of list of complaints, the things that people are saying are wrong with the new iPad, are the yellow screen or unevenness of color on the screen. Some people are saying that's just due to what happens every time a new device comes out, that there's this glue that's on the layer between the LCD panel and the digitizer panel, and it takes a little while for that to cure, and they're shipping these out of the factory so quickly that it doesn't cure. I don't think that's the only thing that's going on here. I think maybe that is the case in some of the cases, but I do think that there are some panels that might have a yellow tint or might not meet the quality standards. And as you're going to hear me say, in all these issues, I think that is the case. Wi-Fi connectivity seems to be getting a lot of buzz right now. A lot of people are saying that they're having intermittent connectivity issues, slow Wi-Fi speeds, inability to connect to a Wi-Fi network or see nearby Wi-Fi networks, specifically on the Wi-Fi-based iPads. I guess this isn't necessarily an issue with the 4G iPads, although we're now hearing two reports that 4G iPads are having issues connecting to 3G networks. So that's another networking problem that's out there. And then I don't even think we need to go into HeatGate. I think we've talked about that a little bit, and that really has come down to a non-issue. As a matter of fact, even Consumer Reports came out and said, yeah, we said that, but it's really not an issue, and the iPad doesn't really get any hotter than any of the Android tablets we've tested. So we won't even talk about HeatGate, but let's just talk about, you know, the yellow screen, Wi-Fi issues, connectivity issues, and stuff like that. Many websites and blogs and things like that are reporting and pointing to sort of the numerous and growing threads on Apple's discussion boards. Thousands of people complaining about these problems, 2,000 people, maybe even 3,000 people, about these quote-unquote serious issues with the iPad, and claiming that there's some sort of defect or problem. And to me, it seems like most of these reports are just attempts to grab eyeballs. They put up big flashy headlines to get traffic and stuff like that. And in some cases, they are being put up by people trying to detract from Apple products, saying, you know, Apple's iPad's not perfect. Look at all these problems that it has. But if you look at those numbers, 1,500, 2,000 posts, I think you can use that number to kind of put things in perspective. So let's just assume that there's 15 times the number of people that have a legitimate, I'm saying they really have something wrong with their iPad. There's a defect. It's got a bad yellow screen. It's got a Wi-Fi problem, a bad chipset, something like that. So that could be on the order of 30,000, maybe 50,000, maybe even 100,000 people that might have any one issue. So let's just assume 30,000 iPads have defective yellow screens. Well, if you put that up against the just the numbers of iPads that Apple sold on the opening weekend of sales, 3 million devices, that's 1% of iPads that Apple are shipping have a legitimate OEM factory defect. To me, I think that's well within normal manufacturing standards to have that happen. And I think that's hardly something that you could call an epidemic or even really cause for concern. Yet Apple's had to kind of address these issues. They've had to send out media PR reports saying that they're looking into these issues. And now they're reportedly investigating the Wi-Fi issues. But the reality is when I talk to people, well, What happened when you found out you had a bad yellow screen or a Wi-Fi issue? Well, I took it back to Apple and they replaced it. They swapped it out. No questions asked. It wasn't a hassle. They stood behind the product. And I think that's about the best thing that they can do. And I don't think that, you know, there's the huge problem that it appears to be like in the media. So I think I just want to point out that here at the MacCast, we try and maintain perspective on these things. And when there is a problem, I will definitely point it out and say there's a problem. But with the new iPad, I really don't think this is a huge epidemic. I do think this is just normal you know, defective products. I've had instances where I've bought a brand new Mac and it came DOA. It happens from time to time. And when you're selling this many iPads in this kind of volume, I think there is going to be that margin of error. And as long as the company stands behind the product and offers you a replacement, I think that we really don't have to be critical or too concerned about that sort of thing. Another thing that I talked about on a recent MacCast was the new version of iPhoto that Apple put out for iOS. I absolutely love it. I think it's a great application. And one of the really cool features that's in it is you now have the ability to view some of the metadata that is in your photos right on the device itself. Well, I received an email from a listener who was wanting to know if there was any good iOS application that would actually let you edit metadata. As far as I can tell, with iPhoto for iOS, all you can do is add a caption to your photo, and that doesn't even seem to actually go into the metadata on the file itself. When you export, that data is not contained in there. It seems to be put into iPhoto itself, into the iPhoto library that's on the iOS device. So the question became, is there any app out there that will allow you to edit and save metadata on your iOS devices for your images? And I know that there's a couple applications out there, and I normally would at this point be recommending one of them to you, but honestly, it's not something that's come up for me, and I haven't tried any of these applications. So what I want to do with this question is actually throw it back out to you and ask you, is there anybody or are you using an application on your iOS device that you really like that's really good for editing and saving metadata and attaching it to your photo files directly on the device so that when you email them off to somebody, they get all of that EXIF metadata contained in those files? And I just have not run across something yet, and I was hoping to get your help. So please send me an email, mattcast@gmail.com, and I'll try and share the kind of top choices from the community on the next MacCast. I find it amazing sometimes, too, how questions come up. I get questions, and sometimes they're related to a specific issue I had or a problem that I had to solve in a given week. And that happened this week when I got an email from Adam, who wanted to know about a good tool for batch renaming files in the Finder. And this had just come up for me. I was working on a project and I had a bunch of image files that I needed to batch rename. And the way I ended up actually renaming them was because, you know, I'm the nerd that I am and I know how to use the command line. I ended up actually using the terminal and command line, a little bash script to actually rename the files. So you could go about it via that method. You could use some sort of combination of awk sed and grep, and if you don't know what that is, you probably don't even need to be worrying about it. But if you do, then you know that you can use those tools to actually batch rename files. And actually, in my case, what I really did was I used a cool command called rename. And rename is not a built-in command that's part of the default OS X install. I actually had to add that to my system. And for that, I use this really cool package manager called Homebrew. Some people might be familiar with MacPorts. It's another OS X package manager. If you use that, you might want to check out Homebrew. I actually really like Homebrew. I'd used MacPorts in the past. And it's actually how I installed another terminal command that's not installed by default, but which is really useful, called wget. And I'll have a link to Homebrew in the show notes at mattcast.com. It's a GitHub repository, and you can install that and use that to install different packages that you might need on your Mac. But for those of you who aren't total command line geeks and just want to do mere mortal kind of stuff, there's a couple other options. If you want to go free, and I've been trying to divide this into free stuff versus some of the commercial applications, but another free way to go for batch renaming is you can actually use Automator. A lot of people don't know that Automator has a pretty easy way to do this. You can create an Automator service and then use that in the Finder to batch rename your files. And it's really pretty simple to do. All you have to do is launch Automator. You go under Applications and you'll find Automator in there. And then when Automator opens up, go ahead and choose to create a new Automator service, select the service type, and then in the column there on the right, in the main area up at the top, it'll ask you what's your starting point. And just make sure you select Files and Folders as the thing that you're going to start with. And then from the left-hand side, you can use the search box and just search for the action called Rename Finder Items. And when you find that, drag that into the main pane, and then you'll get a little pop-up box, and it'll say that this action will change the names of the finder items that are passed into it. Would you like to add a copy finder items action so that the copies are changed and the originals are preserved? So if you want to set up this action so that it keeps a copy of your originals, you're going to want to add that action. Otherwise, you can just add in the rename finder items action and leave it at that. And then in the rename finder items action, go ahead and open up the options section down there at the bottom and check on the show this action when the workflow runs. And the reason we're going to do this is that when you run the service, you can then control how you want to rename the items. It'll pop up a little dialog box each time, and you can customize the settings dependent upon what you need for that specific instance of when you're renaming those files. And the options are, you can add a date or timestamp to the file name. You can add some text to the file name. You can change the case. You can make it sequential. So if you just want to add a numbering scheme to the file name, you can do that. You can replace text, or you can give it a new single name. Just simply rename the file with a specific name. You'll have all those options when you actually run the little script. And that once you've added in just that one action, or if you chose to add in the copy action, you'll have two actions in your Automator script. Go ahead and choose Save from the file menu, and then give it the name that you want to see in the Services menu when it comes up. Something like Rename Files is probably a good thing to call it. And hit Save, and you're done. And now you can go into the Finder. You can select the items that you want to rename, even select a whole batch of them, and then right-click or control-click, go down to the Services menu, and you should see that Rename Files action. Pick that, and it'll pop up the little dialog box. Put in the parameters you want to rename the files with, and you're done. You know, hit run, and it should go through and run your Automator script and rename all your files. So that's pretty straightforward and easy. It is a little bit trickier to work with. It maybe is a little bit limiting, dependent upon how you want to do your renaming, because you just have the specific options that Automator gives you. So if that's not enough for you, you might want to look into some of the commercial options. And I actually sent out a tweet earlier this week asking what the best renaming applications are. And the two that came back are the two that I have used in the past and really like. So I feel pretty confident in recommending these. The first one's called Better Finder Rename. It's $19.99, and it's from Public Space, publicspace.net. Or check out Name Mangler, and that one is $9.99 US. It's from Manytrix, and they're the folks that make Butler and Witch, another couple other great utilities that you should probably check out while you're over there. And those two renaming applications are really great, and I'll have links to those in the show notes at maccast.com. They're both also available on the Mac App Store if you want to pick them up there. And so there's a couple different options for batch renaming your files in the Finder if you need to do that. I had a listener ask me recently about macOS 10 Lion Server, and specifically he wanted to know if Server had the ability to reboot itself if the system froze or locked up, so that in that instance, if you were running a server, you'd want it to be able to sort of auto-resurrect itself and put itself back into service, so that if your website was being hosted on there, say, for example, that your server wouldn't be down forever until someone had to physically go reboot it. You know, could the machine kind of self-maintain and self-take care of itself? And you know, at first, I didn't think that OS X actually had that feature or ability. I think I had heard about maybe that being built into like some hardware, like a UPS or something like that, and a feature where you could sort of remote reboot and get an alert, and it would tell you that, hey, your server is down, you need to do something about it. Or you could set up some server monitoring tools to allow you to at least be notified when something like that happened. But I told him, no, I don't think that capability exists. And he wrote me back and kind of prodded me a little bit more, and that forced me to go in and look. You know, he said, this is a pretty common feature in a lot of professional servers, and I'd be surprised if OS X server doesn't have that. And so when I started doing digging and doing a little more research, lo and behold, I found out that the feature actually does exist. It was added in Mac OS X Lion, but not just in Lion server, but it's also in the client. So if you'd like to turn the setting on, you'll find it tucked away in the system preferences under Energy Saver. And if you're on a notebook, it's under the power adapter tab. If you're on a desktop, I believe it's just under the power tab. And there's a little checkbox that says restart automatically if computer freezes. So I don't know specifically how this works or how it detects that the system's locked up or even how it can actually know to kind of reboot itself, but I assume it works. And you can just flip that on if you'd like to have that. And I just thought I'd point out also while you're there, you might want to check out the scheduling feature because I think not a lot of people know or are aware that you have the ability to actually schedule your Mac turning on and off. So if you're in that same Energy Saver preferences pane, you look down in the lower right-hand corner, you'll see a little schedule button. If you click on that, you can actually schedule a time and days that you want your Mac to start up or wake up if you just let it go to sleep. And you can even also set up sleep, shutdown, and restart times. So you can play around with those settings a little bit. And if you want even finer control over those Energy Saver settings, I probably should mention, I told you Phoronix is a sponsor of the show, and they have a product called PowerSave Mac. And it allows you to do even more flexible scheduling than what Apple will let you do built in. And you can control the timing of sleep functions and shutdown and stuff like that based on all kinds of different parameters. So you can look at CPU and disk and network activity and decide when you want the system to go to sleep or wake up and for how long and stuff like that. It really allows you to tweak that stuff. And you can even get reports on the kinds of energy savings that you're getting using the product. So you can check that out over at Phoronix.com or just play around with the built-in stuff that's in Mac OS X. So I want to thank that listener for sending in his question and keeping on me about the fact that, hey, that feature has to be in there. Sometimes it takes a little more digging to unearth this stuff. And then finally for today, I got an email from Bruce, and he was having a real odd issue with updating his software that he purchased through the Mac App Store. So he had the little indicator on his App Store icon in his dock and went to update his applications and ran the update, and everything went fine, everything updated. But then the notification kind of remained there in the dock and said, you still have this many applications to update. And he's kind of scratching his head and went, yeah, I thought I already updated those. And so he'd launch the Mac App Store again and then run those updates, and then they would run fine again, and then everything would be okay, and then it would be all updated. But it was like having to, every time an app updated, update it twice. And so we were emailing back and forth trying to figure out what was going on, and it turns out that Bruce does a backup, which is great. Just like I'm always harping on you guys about backup, and he's doing his backups. But the problem was is that Spotlight was also indexing that external cloned backup drive. And so in essence, he had two copies of every application, one on his internal drive and one on the external drive. And the only thing that I can guess at is that for some reason, the App Store is using the Spotlight database or information that's in Spotlight, or maybe the Launch Services database to determine what applications that it needs to update and where those applications are. And so what we ended up doing was telling Spotlight not to index the external backup drive. And so the way you do this is if you go into the System Preferences and then go into the Spotlight Preferences, you can actually add volumes or individual files under the Privacy tab to the list there by clicking the little plus button and adding whatever volume or folder that you'd like to, and it will not index that volume. And so simply by doing that on Bruce's system, it stopped this problem of wanting to update every application twice. Now, of course, when you're searching in Spotlight, you're not going to find the applications that are on the external backup drive, but chances are you don't want that to happen anyway. And I'll point out that this same trick is very useful if you've ever seen or had the problem where you control click or right click on a file, maybe in the Finder, and you go to that little open with menu, and you suddenly see that you have duplicates of every application in there. Well, yeah, that's the launch services database that's on your Mac, and that gets populated in a similar way. So if you run a super duper backup like I do, you often would end up with duplicates in there if you don't exclude that information from the Spotlight indexing. So you probably want to turn that on in that case, and that'll clean that up. Although you might have to run a tool like Onyx or Cocktail to clear out or reset the launch services database and kind of force that to happen if you've already ended up with those duplicates in there. But once you put everything into that exclusion list, you should be all cleaned up and okay. And that worked for Bruce, so I thought I'd just point that out in case any of you ran into a similar issue on your Mac. And with that, that's going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Pharonix, makers of Deep Freeze, you can check out their software, get more information and details over at pharonix.com. Circus Ponies, check out Notebook, a great application for taking notes and getting yourself organized. You can find more information and details as well as trials over at circusponies.com. Smile, they make Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, Text Expander Touch for iOS, and also now PDF Pen for iOS. You can check out all of their software, get more information and details, as well as trials over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle, get cash for all your old Apple gear. Just do a simple search over at gazelle.com and get an offer. Check it out. Get more information and details over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. I'd like to mention that I was recently a guest on a new Mac show over in the UK. It's actually a podcast on the British Tech Network, and it's currently the number one tech podcast in the UK iTunes store. So you can check it out over there. You can also check it out at BritishTechNetwork.com. And I was on with Bart Bashatz and Don McAllister from Screencasts Online. So it was a great panel. They had us on and we talked about everything that's been happening in Mac news this week. So if you're in the UK, or actually if you're anywhere in the world and you want to check out a really cool new podcast, it's a video podcast as well as audio podcast. You can find it over there or on iTunes, and I want to thank them for having me on. It was a lot of fun, so check that out. If you have any feedback for me, any comments, any questions, anything you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, please feel free to send in audio comments or just an email. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, or you can leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I've talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the MacCast website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/maccast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/themaccast. And that's kind of all the places you can find me between shows. And that's going to do it for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.